I'm Doug Chapman. I'm from Hewlett-Packard. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My day-to-day job is normally I work on our large IA64 systems, primarily with Red Hat and Fedora, making sure things work well on these really, really big systems. That's not what I'm talking about today, of course. This is really kind of on the other scale, more on the very small systems. About a year ago, I started this project. It's something I've done a few times off and on over the past 10 or 15 years, where there's a robotics competition that I've entered a few times. And each time I enter it, I try out something completely new that I know very little about just to learn it. The first one I did was simply learning how to use PIC microcontrollers, small little 8-bit microcontrollers. And it didn't work very well, but I learned a lot on that. A few years later, I built one that ran on Java on a little 8-bit Motorola processor, which, because I wanted to learn Java, I was doing some Java stuff with my job. So, hey, what better interesting project to learn Java with than to build a robot? Well, just last year, I was starting to do some more kernel work with my job, so I wanted to, I've been a longtime Linux user for kernel version 0.99 something, whenever that is. But I really hadn't done that much real kernel work, so I wanted to do something where I had a chance to get more into the internals of the kernel, write some device drivers and things like that. So, hey, what better project to do than to build a robot that runs Linux? So here's a picture of the robot here. To give you a sense of scale, the rules of the competition are it must fit within a 30-centimeter cube, and it comes pretty close to that that size here, just to give you an idea of how large it is. Two-wheeled robot with a caster wheel, steers simply by changing the speed of the wheels. It's got various sensors to avoid walls, and up along the top, see if I can get my mouse to work, up here and off to the sides, what those are infrared photo transistors I use to pick up a flame, and you'll see why we do that when I talk about the actual competition. The contest that I've entered this in, it's Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, in the northeast part of the United States. First of all, it's in the U.S. we have this thing on TV called BattleBots. I assume you have something similar here where you have remote-controlled fighting robots, and it's really cool and sparks and everything. It's not what this is. That I find that really interesting, and of course, people always, first thing they ask me when I say I'm building a robot, well, what kind of weapons does it have? I find that interesting, of course, and that's something I've thought about doing someday, but this is on the other end of the spectrum. This is a fully autonomous robot. You turn it on, there is no human interaction with it. It needs to be able to deal with its environment and do a task by itself. The point of the goal of this competition is to make a firefighting robot. It gets set down in a maze that's supposed to look roughly like a floor plan of a house, and they light a candle in one of the rooms. The robot has to search out the maze, find the candle, and extinguish it. And if I go back a page, you'll see that's just a CPU cooling fan on the front, which is my very high-tech way of extinguishing a flame. Simple and reliable. There's multiple divisions of this competition. The great thing about how they do this competition is there's a division that kids can enter their Lego Mindstorms in, and it's a simplified version of the competition where they can start to get involved, and then it goes all the way up into the expert division that I entered, where the big differences are you don't know the layout of the maze ahead of time, so it's got to be able to deal with not getting lost in a completely arbitrary environment. There's two candles throughout the maze that has to go and find both of them. And also they have a simulated baby, which is just a small incandescent light bulb that's painted flat black, the idea being it looks sort of like body heat. And the idea with that is you're supposed to find the baby and drop a beeper in that room so that, in theory, a real fireman could go in and save the baby is what they're simulating. Here's a rough idea of what the maze might look like. Like I said, they don't tell you what the maze looks like until you show up, and they actually change the layout of the maze throughout the day. But the corridors are about, 30 or 40 centimeters wide. And it's usually laid out on a grid like this. So, people who do want to try to, measure out exactly how far they've gone and build a real-world map could, but that doesn't actually work out real well. And you'll notice they do things like, if you're following One wall, you can end up going in a circle forever and ever, so you do need some level of navigation so that you don't get stuck in one area of the maze. And what's not shown on here is actually there'll be an opening that's the same width as the hallway on one edge that goes to a ramp that goes up to a second story. And I don't know, I took this from the website of the contest. So it's really hard to tell, but some of the lines are bolder. Those are the actual walls. So the idea is it's a smaller second story. There's two rooms up there with a ramp going up to it. And typically what they do is there'll be one candle upstairs, one candle downstairs. It needs to be able to find both of those and then the baby somewhere in the maze. Okay, so now that we know about the competition, so let's start building a robot. First thing we need is we need some kind of a, it's a physical thing. It's not just a computer. A lot of people do, you can actually buy, start out with a pre-made kit that's, got motors and maybe some sensors on it. A lot of people do that. I like building things, so I built everything from scratch. So for the physical body of the robot, of course, using a Xfig, which is for those who aren't familiar, it's a simple drawing program, been around on Unix for years, runs great on Linux. And every bit of software I used here, of course, runs on Linux. I drew out designs for various panels, labeled where all my holes were going to be, and then printed them out, stuck them to a piece of plastic. I was able to cut those pieces out, and the reason I was going through that much detail is originally I planned on doing a couple robots like this. Of course, ran out of time and only ended up building one. But there's an example of a side panel up top. I've got the holes, laid out for mounting the motors, which has always been one of the tricky things, actually physically mounting a motor to the body. The top panel down here, and to the upper, these aren't all on the same scale, I just pulled in various drawings into this. And then the upper right is the wheel blank for the center for the wheels that I made. And this picture, actually, this shows up fairly well on this projector. Sometimes it doesn't show up so well. But you can see all the plastic parts that I cut out there, laid out before I assembled them. Just sheets of PVC plastic. The white bits are actually PVC trim that you would use on a house, the stuff that doesn't rot that replaces wood trim. And on the other picture are two of the wheels that I made. And those are just thicker sheets of PVC that I cut out. And the rubber part is a two-part silicone that's normally used for mold making. I made a mold, put the wheel center in, and cast my own wheels that way. Okay, so now that we've got some sort of a physical body for the robot, we need some electronics. And the main controller for the robot, I'll talk about a little bit later, that part runs Linux. However, for interfacing with the real world, I needed more analog to digital converters so that I could take an analog signal and interface it to the robot. And there's some hardware that will do just A to D conversion, but I'm kind of partial to doing things with, I have a digital brain, so I'll try to do things where I can do it more in software than in hardware. So I created some simple boards that they do a little bit of averaging of signals and things like that, but mostly what they do is they take these analog signals in from my various sensors, and then they communicate with the arm that runs Linux over an I2C bus. So I use these AVR, AT Mega 32 is the particular model of the AVR. There's probably 100 different variants of the AVR processor. They're a simple 8-bit microprocessor, or microcontroller, technically. And the beauty of these, I've used a few different kinds of microcontrollers over the years. The beauty of the AVRs is they're probably the most friendly as far as open source tools. GCC will generate code for it. There's a simple downloading program to actually program the boards that's open source. The company that makes them does have their own compiler, and it probably has some great features that if you're doing professional design, maybe you could take advantage of those. But for what I'm doing, honestly, I was very impressed with how easy these were to do. And also, the AVR microcontrollers, it doesn't take much to get them running, so I was able to design my own boards, not being a hardware designer. And first try, I drew them up in a CAD program, sent them off to be manufactured, and they actually worked first time. So that says a lot. And the one bit of non-open source software I used was the Eagle CAD design program, electronics CAD program. It runs under Linux, but it's not open source. Great thing about coming here to OLS, I've been talking to some of the embedded guys, and I've got some ideas for some full open source tools I'll probably use next time. Here's a, just to show you how simple the boards are. This actually looks a little more complex than it is, but most of what you see there are simple headers that I can use to connect to other things. The only things you actually need to get the AVR to do something are, you'll see there's a resistor in the upper left that ties the reset pin high, a couple of capacitors just to filter out some noise, and then my high-tech output device, you'll see about halfway down on the right, there's an LED connected to a resistor so I can flash lights for debug codes. In theory, that's all you need to have a working system, and then, you know, the other pins I can simply hook to other hardware, like to my sensors for input. And one of the just like the second one up there is the I2C header that is my communication bus with my host computer. And here's a view from the top of the robot. You can see the boards that I designed in the upper right. There's actually a stack of three of them. They're on a daisy-chained bus for the communication. And the ribbon cables going up to the front of the robot are the input channels for my analog flame sensors. And a few of the sensors that I'm using. I mentioned the flame sensors. Of course, you need some obstacle sensors. The top one there is a infrared distance sensor. Can give you a direct value based on reflectance of the infrared light that it shines out. Of course, sonar sensors, I use a couple of those. Sonars actually are not my favorite just because they're not as reliable as people might think, because they'll pick up cracks in the floor and look like a wall. The bottom one there is what I'm using to find the simulated baby I mentioned. That's simply a heat sensor that's in like a motion detector light that when you walk across someone's driveway, it turns the light on. Those are actually keyed off of heat around the level of body heat. Okay, so the part that people here are probably most interested in is the actual Linux part. What I'm using is an ARM microcontroller. It's a single board computer. It's this is not something I designed myself, of course. This is much higher, much more complex than I'd be able to design. And luckily, these have gotten popular enough in the last few years you can get these fairly cheap. This one was under $200. It's about 3 inches by 4 inches. I'll let you do the metric conversion yourself there. It's very convenient to program on. It's got a RS-232 serial port that you can use as the console. It's got an Ethernet port on board, a wired Ethernet that it can actually boot. It can network boot a kernel, which makes doing kernel development very easy. You don't need to copy your kernel over to the flash device and then boot it. You just simply have that out on a TFTP server, reset it, and you're booting your new kernel, which saves a lot of time. I had to do some initial kernel work to get the kernel booted on this. And probably the most useful thing is it's got onboard USB, which allows me to do things like run wireless Ethernet. And here, a little hard to see. It's a little cluttered in there. Actually, as time goes by, as I've built more robots, they get less cluttered inside. So you can imagine what my older ones looked like. They're really quite scary. And you can see my ARM single board computer. The single board computer is what's called a PC-104 form factor, which allows you to plug in PC-104 expansion cards on it, which is, it's actually based on the old ISA bus. It's just a different form factor so that they stack. So what you actually see here is, this part here is a digital I/O board. Just below it is a full-length analog-to-digital converter, and underneath that is the actual ARM. And some other various components that I soldered up myself. You'll notice up towards the front, the USB wireless adapter. Had to tuck the cable around the corner and to get everything to fit. And right up here, there's also a USB flash drive, which allows, since there's only 32 mega flash, and it's also built onto the board, and with flash only having, you know, a finite number of write cycles, I'd like to be using this for years and years. I don't want to have to solder a new flash device on there. I'm doing most of my read-write work on the USB flash drive. And I mentioned the communications, which is really what makes this such an easy thing to program. Also on the side, you'll note that I carried out my RS-232 serial and my RJ45 jack for wired Ethernet, so I don't have to open it up to plug into those. Normally, now that I've got things working, I actually only tend to communicate with it over the wireless Ethernet unless something goes wrong. So the challenges of getting the kernel working. The company that makes this actually is pretty Linux friendly. They sell it with a 2.4 kernel. However, since my whole entire goal of doing this was to learn some more kernel development, part of the excitement is let's run the latest and greatest kernel on there, which the company doesn't do, but there are some mailing lists with people, other people using these. So I was able to find some various patches from other people. Still didn't quite get it working with just those patches, because they did a fairly strange thing on the layout of the board where the physical addresses of the memory are not laid out contiguously. Me being more of a user space guy, I'm used to just asking for memory, there it is. And being down in the kernel, it's you got to deal with the physical addresses. So I was able to, it was myself and some other people on the list who also weren't real kernel hackers. We were able to get it working with the sparse mem options on the kernel so that it could handle those big gaps in the kernel, which was very educational for me. So we got 2.6.20 running on it, which about a year ago was the latest kernel of the time. The real key that I wanted to learn was how to write some device drivers. I pointed out when the digital I/O card that's plugged into that, what that gives me is 24 general purpose input and output pins. They can either send out a 5-volt signal or read if someone else is, at 0 or 5 volts. And I'm using these to actually control my motor drivers. The company that makes it, once again, they've got some good examples, but their example code to use this all worked in user space. It just mapped devmem and read and write, did an mmap and read and write addresses, which it does work, but it's not a clean way to do it, and I wanted to learn how to write a device driver. So using that, the convenient thing is I had example code. I knew how the device worked. I didn't have to worry about misinterpreting the hardware specs on that device. I was able to see, okay, I know exactly what needs to be read and written. It's just a matter of writing the device driver. So that was actually quite useful way for someone who's never written a device driver to actually write a real device driver that talks to real hardware versus, if you look in textbooks, the device drivers are things like, you write a character to it and it changes that character and writes it back, which is interesting. It tells you how to talk between user space and kernel space, but this goes one step beyond and allows user space to talk through kernel space to a physical device. Within the kernel, I was able to do the pulse width modulation code as part of this driver. The way you control the motor speed is by pulsing the enable line either, just as a duty cycle. You can leave it on solid, it'll give 100% power to the motor, or pulse it at approximately 50% to get half speed. So I did that inside the kernel where it did it on the timer interrupt. It would check if it needs to raise or lower that pin. So I got into some timer interrupt sort of things. I mentioned the AVR boards that I designed talk to the Linux host through an I2C protocol. I2C has been around for quite a few years. It's actually used on motherboards sometimes to talk to other components. Typically seems temperature sensors within that board are often talked to through an I2C protocol. It's a very simple protocol, only requires two wires plus a common ground, but one is used for data, the other one is toggled for the clock, so you don't have to worry about synchronization like you would with an RS-232 protocol, where the master and the slave have to be on the same clock. This, the master toggles the clock, which shifts bits in or out. It's a very robust protocol and fairly simple. Problem I ran into is a slave device, if it's busy, can pull that clock line low so that nothing can happen on the bus. And I didn't think that'd cause problems, but it turns out it actually does, because the Linux kernel has got a a bit banged driver, because the board that I use doesn't have the capability in hardware to talk I2C. Sometimes you can actually have a device that in hardware will take care of shifting bits in and out and controlling the clock, and that doesn't have to be taken care of by the kernel. My board doesn't have that, unfortunately. So I had to use what's called the BitBang I2C driver, which is in the kernel tree. Doesn't appear to be commonly used, I discovered, because it works, but it turns out there were problems. As I was building up the robot and adding more things to it and adding more code, I realized all of a sudden it would just occasionally just, like, it's not even reading its sensors, it'd crash into the wall. It's like, oh, well, that's not good, obviously. So I, in the process of debugging this, is my code is very modular. I can pull different things in and out, and I can test each module independently, and each module seemed to be doing exactly what I expected. It's when I tried pushing a lot of data through it, it turned out that one of my sonar devices, which I don't have control over the firmware on the sonars, that's a bit of hardware that I bought pre-made from a company that also talks on the I2C bus. It turns out that when you tell it to send out a ping, it holds the line low until it's ready to say, yes, I've got that ping back. And this actually confused the Linux code, because if it's trying to send another byte on the I2C bus, it looks and sees, oh, the bus line's held low. That means one of the client or the slave devices is busy and I can't talk. It just sat there and polled on it. Did nothing else, just sat there and polled, waiting for that clock line to come high. So, at first it wasn't clear that that was going on, but I did some profiling with the OProfile tool on the kernel, looked at everything that was going on, dug through the code, and, I found this busy loop. So, well, great opportunity for me to do some more device driver work, of course. I was able to rewire things, and the nice thing about the I2C driver that's in the kernel is it's designed to be configured so that you use any two general purpose I/O pins that you have on the board. So I rewrote it and specifically chose a pin where I can use as an interrupt pin. And if it was busy, it would it would block that thread so something else could run, and then it would simply interrupt it when the clock line came high and it was able to do able to send the next byte along the bus. It still didn't work perfectly. As I mentioned, I'm not a real kernel guy. I just try to, I'm more the guy who finds the one-line bugs and fixes them. Things at this level are a little bit beyond me, but I did learn quite a bit from that, and I got it working fairly reliably to the point where the robot would work again. Okay, so now that we've got the basic hardware and a kernel going, we need an environment to actually run programs under. So, people have asked, is it a Debian robot? Is it a Fedora robot? And actually, with 32 meg of RAM or 32 meg of flash space, there really isn't room for a distribution of any sort. But there really isn't a need for one. All it needs is, some kind of a shell environment and a few other odds and ends so that you can, boot it, configure it, and run a program. So the entire distribution is, simply the kernel that I talked about already. A utility called BusyBox, which, for those not familiar, BusyBox is a single binary that can act like every shell command, usually without all the features because it's optimized for size. But it's got all the shell commands. It's got like your ifconfig to bring up your network, and you can configure things in and out of it as needed. So I was able to do that, make a nice simple binary that does almost everything. The only things I had to add on top of that is I added a utility called DropBear, which actually I learned about from the BusyBox web pages because it's commonly used. Since BusyBox doesn't have the ability to do an SSH daemon server. So I added that in there. Also some shared libraries that are needed by my program. And a really handy thing if you're doing embedded programming is this thing called GDB server. There really isn't enough horsepower to run GDB to debug programs directly on it. In theory, you could do it, but it's obviously going to be slow, and you're going to use up most of your space just for GDB. GDB server is just a stubbed-out version of GDB that can talk to the program and open up a network port, or you can also do it over a serial port, where on another computer you can connect to that and you've got all the smarts of GDB on one end and all the stubs on your embedded device. So that certainly helped with some of the debugging. Okay, so actually writing code for the bot is it's really quite simple. In the past, I've always done more traditional embedded programming. And also, this is kind of how I'm doing it on my AVRs, but the AVRs, I'm not doing enough code for it to be a problem. Normally, you have to compile your code on a desktop system. You need to pick the robot up. You need to shut it off, plug it in the serial port, bring it up into download mode, copy your program on, reset the robot, turn it on, and then see if your code works. Which, when you want to make one little change, that can get to be a little bit time consuming. The beauty of this running Linux in a full environment is with my wireless Ethernet, I was able to run NFS over the wireless Ethernet. I'm not doing that now, but when I was doing the initial development, I would run NFS. I would NFS mount the directory where my code was. On my desktop system, I could edit it and compile it using the cross-compiler. I'm running on an x86 desktop system, but cross-compiling to build this all in the ARM format. And then it's simply a matter of, from my desk, I've got an SSH session to the robot. I hit Control C to kill that version of the program. I start the new version. Boom, I'm running a new one. I didn't even have to touch the robot. So that's very helpful when you want to make one little change. Like, what if I increase this value? Or what if I change the order of these priorities on something? You can simply sit in your chair, start it up again, and it really reduces the temptation of, well, I want to make this change, and this change. Well, now it doesn't work. Okay, which change was it that caused it to not work? So it really did streamline the programming. Actually, I should put a slide in there that says I did win the expert division. I should mention that in the first slide, I guess. Thank you. So why did I win is probably the question. In fact, I even surprised myself, and I surprised a few of the people that talked to me, because a couple days before it, the competition, of course, it wasn't working quite right. But a lot of the people entering the competition ran into some of the common pitfalls that I've seen a few times. It's really easy to do something like this and think, well, it's simple. It goes down the hallway and it blows out a candle. Oh, it's hard about that. Well, then they realize that, it crashes into walls all the time. Why is that? The simple things, for us as a person, it's easy to walk down a hall and, stay and not bounce into walls. Depending, Saturday night, you'll probably see, or Friday night after the Google party, who knows if that'll be the case. But for, an embedded device, it's got a very narrow view of the world. It's just got a few values from sensors looking at walls. So people tend to think at this high level, it's like, okay, yeah, it'll move around and put out fires. Yeah, that part's easy. But, I want to build this complex map. I want to do all this high-level AI. I want it to, build a map as it goes so it knows that it's gone through every room and does it in the most efficient method. And then they don't spend the time, building something that simply goes down the hall and doesn't crash. And then, towards the end, they realize, it can't go down the hall. They start working at that level and run out of time. So, of course, the old acronym, keep it simple, stupid, or keep it stupid and simple, however you want to say it. Start early and you make something that works. The first thing I did was on the front of the robot, there's a bump sensor. If it hits something, it knows to back up. That's the first bit of code I wrote, once I got the infrastructure of, actually being able to spin a motor and things like that. You set it on a table, bump that, it backs away from it. Okay, that's the start of my robot programming. Next thing I do is, it's got the distance sensors. And, you simply make it so that, it appears to be afraid of things. You you tell it, if something's too close on one side, turn away. So you write that bit of code. It doesn't touch any of the existing bumper code. That's all there, that works. You create the code that helps it avoid things. And then, you want to make it actually do something. Another thread that simply tries to move forward. Well, you take all these behavioral threads, and then you give each one a priority. Obviously, the bumper one's the most important. That's the highest priority. No matter what happens, if my bumper is hit, I back up and turn away. And then, all the way up to, so you've got different priorities for things like, avoiding a wall with your infrared sensors, or you know, putting out the candle, and you reason all these things out, and you make them nice, simple, individual threads. Each one is very easy to test, because you can shut off all the threads and just make sure, does this thread do what I expect? If I put a candle in front of it, does the fan turn on? There's really a thread that does very little more than that. It's not tied in with all the navigation and avoiding things. It's just one more simple thread that that can take care of a simple action. What all that is based on is a thing called the subsumption architecture that was developed by Rodney Brooks, who's now a professor at MIT. He also did his undergraduate work there. He's either Australian or New Zealand. Is he? Okay. So people, I knew he was from down under somewhere. A few years ago, he looked at this, looked at some of the AI work that was going on, and he saw these overly complex methods of doing nothing, essentially, because they really didn't work, and they were overthinking the problem. And he started thinking, well, an ant walks along. An ant doesn't have, it only has a finite number of neurons. It can't be that smart, yet that ant appears to be smarter than this robot. He started reasoning out this whole idea of subsumption and multiple behaviors. And so best way to show this is I'll actually get out of my slides here. And we'll see if this actually works. But I was going to bring the robot originally, but with trying to get it through customs, and honestly, the last time I carried it halfway across the United States, I ended up rebuilding it because it got damaged. So this is actually a live feed that we have from my workshop back in New Hampshire in the United States. So we'll see if this works. In this window, you see I'm just doing an SSH, and for some reason, it's really slow doing an SSH. And you can see it's just a normal Linux system. It's just much smaller. I can run commands and everything here. And if I go to where my USB stick is mounted, and my very original name of Maine, it's about a 5 or 10 second delay. But okay, there you can see it's actually moving about. Now the code on this, it's really honestly, it's pretty dumb, and that's part of what made it so. Made it work so well in the competition is it's dumb and reliable. Where most of the people would get hung up on something, this one, there were times it went into the same room 3 or 4 times and missed another room completely, but it always continued to move forward and explore.
It's like a pool sweeper.
Yeah, it's a lot like that, or the Roomba vacuum, where it doesn't have a whole lot of intelligence, but it keeps moving around. Actually, it's bouncing, yeah. It's following the left wall, and it's got a lot of rules for simple rules for like right there, it had just bumped into the corner of that wall, and it backed up and turned. And is it stuck? And I think it's trying to. Yeah, who knows. Oh, okay, Paul's asking if it's. Hang on a second. Oh. I squared C bad. As I was mentioning, actually, Alex is helping me communicate, so that's him you see talking there. Let's see if I can restart it. Every once in a while, and luckily this never happened during the competition, but every once in a while it gets into this state where my I squared C driver gets hung. And I don't know why, and I haven't figured it out, and I actually have to, So hopefully, Paul will go reset it for me, and we'll have it up in a little bit. So, and this actually worked better than I expected. I expected the video to be a problem, but I thought the robot would work just fine. my background's in QA. This is Paul. Say hello to Paul. Paul's also a network expert. That's why I had him there, because I thought I'd have networking problems with my video feed. It takes a little while to reboot, and unfortunately, I won't know other than that I can log in again, but hopefully that will have time stuff. So my background's in QA, which I think was really a big help to me, because most of what I did is I spent lots of time... I spent lots of time testing. And as I mentioned, it's easy to, you know, change a program, run it. So I'd sit there in my chair with the beer and watch it run for a couple hours and wait for it to get run into a situation where it didn't work. Obviously, this didn't happen, though, back then. This is something that just started happening recently, where it started happening this often with the I2C driver. But, you know, it a lot of, you know, design, test, and redesign, and just constantly doing that, and, you know, keeping backups of my code in case I need to roll back to something.
Can you ever wrap your beer to debugging ability ratio?
I should probably measure that. That'd be an interesting statistic. So that's when it does come back up, I'll actually have Paul light a candle, and we can see it putting the flame out. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for it to reboot, do we have any questions?
Does it ever knock over the candle and catch on fire?
It's never caught on fire, but yes, it has knocked over the candle a few times. Yeah?
Put the fan on, so I presume it thought that there was a candle on.
I'm wondering. I don't know. The nice thing is I have all the high efficiency compact fluorescent lights in my workshop, which these sensors don't pick up. I think actually it was more the because I was getting my I2C messages. Let's see if it's rebooted here. Okay, so it is back up. Hopefully it will continue to work this time. We'll wait till Paul's got a candle lit. So any other questions, or you had another? Yeah.
I have two questions. You said that the PWM signals with the timer interrupt.
Yep.
The AVRs, as far as I know, have especially pins for it, which doing this in hardware and save some software cycles.
That's actually next year's design. Yeah, I plan on doing that in hardware. A big part of the problem is at 100 hertz, that's really too slow to do really good PWM control. So it has a little trouble with this small room. Okay, it sees the candle, it's going towards it. It'll probably run over because usually I have to manually aim the sensors a couple times. And, okay, but I think it's actually going to put it out. Yay. Yep, and I think the candle's out. It's hard to tell. And.
Does stopping it count as putting it out in the competition?
Does what?
Stomping
on it? you lose points if you run into it, but as long as you put it out, that's the important thing. The way they score the competition, it's based primarily on how many tasks you achieved, and then if there's a tiebreaker, there's things like points, like did you bump into it? Luckily, that wasn't a problem. So we'll see if it finds it again here.
Was there a time limit?
It's a 6-minute run that they do. And okay, yeah, it actually... It's bumping into the candle. I'm backing up, but it should put it out here. Yeah, so it's... has a better view there, too. Yeah, the way the competition works is you get 3 runs, total of 6 minutes for each run, and you know you try to put out both candles, find the baby. Oh, I probably should say more about the whole thing of finding the baby. The beeper and everything isn't mounted on here just because... it honestly doesn't work all that well. It actually did find the baby on one of the 3 runs, but it dropped the beeper out in the hallway. And even the judge had said, well, that's pretty cool. We should give half a point for that. But the other times it got a false read because there's enough people in the background. Sometimes it'll trigger off of that. And it would drop the beeper at the wrong time. The motor controllers that I'm using, and actually I didn't get into my last couple of slides talks about some pointers to software websites and pointer to hardware suppliers that if you look at my slides afterwards, but there's a company called I'm not sure how POLOLU. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but they make a nice motor controller that I'm using. It's simple to interface. It's something that in theory I would put it all on the same board, but I'm not a big hardware guy, and I wanted to worry more about getting software working and not spend too much time.
How many
PWM
channels are you using?
How many PWM channels? Just two. Yeah, here's Paul's making a little trick here. He's putting some obstacles out there for it to have to work around, which it actually deals with fairly well. It'll probably nudge them out of the way. Yeah, I only have two PWM channels just for the two motors. It's not balancing. There's a caster wheel on the back. Yeah, it's weighted more towards the back, and it simply steers by spinning one wheel faster than the other. I have sensors underneath it that are counting wheel rotation, so I'm not really using it much. That's something that, just like everybody else, I had all these really great high-level ideas that never quite got implemented, and I wanted to build maps and things like that.
Essentially, following a left-hand rule, what happens if there's a part of the maze that can't be reached by left-hand rule?
Right now, I do have it just following the left wall, just because sometimes, in a demo, I'll be expecting it to do something. I'm really quite impressed that this works from the other side of the world. I shot video of it also that I was going to show just in case this part didn't work. What I was doing in the actual competition is the real high-level navigation was follow the left wall for 1 minute, follow the right wall for 1 minute, follow the left wall for 1 minute, which is basically because I ran out of time for doing real high-level AI. But it actually was pretty reliable, and I kind of played with that through the competition for my three different runs. But here something I can do, actually. I wanted to show just how easy it is to reprogram this. Let me open up another window here while Paul's lighting a candle there. But if I log into my desktop system, which takes a little while, and see if I.
You got for a few cases of beer there.
Okay, right now, notice how I've got current direction equals left. So let's say, change that to right, if I can type, that is. So simply doing that, typing make, it'll recompile it with the cross compiler, and then copy the code over, which for some reason my SSH seems to be a little slow. I haven't quite understood that. So now we've got a new version of the code, and to show that it really is, and this is not pre-recorded, it should follow the right wall now. If it finds its way out of the corner. Okay. So now, of course, Paul made it cluttered for me, and it's got to find its way around that. But that's one of the things I did. I would set these up, and I'd find situations where it doesn't work, and I'd sit there and I'd reason, okay, what would be a good way to get out of this? And I'd make some code changes, I'd retest that situation, and I'd retest a bunch of other situations. Did I break anything else? Of course, now it seems to be stuck in that area. But there's enough randomness, honestly, that it won't really get stuck in a loop forever and ever.
What is the source? Is it just the randomization of the timing on the motor stopping?
Exactly. It's the randomization of dealing with the real world.
Of random.
It's completely a reactionary-based robot. It doesn't know it's going down a hallway. It's simply avoiding walls. It doesn't know it's following a wall. It's simply trying to keep that wall within a certain amount of distance. And you put all these behaviors together, it starts to look like something intelligent. This is actually one of the more difficult areas for it to get in. It sometimes bounces off the. Hopefully.
I guess a lot of it kind of has to do with how the maze is set up, too, mm-hmm. which whether or not it favors you to get around it with the right hand.
Yeah.
And this one is going to take it a while. It's probably going to have to go all the way.
Yeah, hopefully it'll find its way back out there. It's actually trying to follow the wall. It'll try, if it gets too far from the wall, it'll try to get back closer, just so it doesn't get, because otherwise it wouldn't find its way out of rooms. Because if it was simply just going and trying to avoid things once it got there, it'd never make it out.
That right here freaks it out.
So I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear the... Yeah, there's certainly situations that it would run into problems. Yeah, it's I don't know, it's getting stuck because it keeps turning and catching on that.
What's the range of the infrared sensor?
Yeah, eventually it probably would get that. And, in the real competition, it actually did a pretty good job of hitting all the rooms, but there was one situation where it never, kind of like this, where it just never managed to find its way in. So we'll have Paul move it someplace else, just because we want to see it put the candle out. That's the fun part.
What time is it there at the moment?
Actually, it's 11:18. I haven't set my laptop yet, so it's 11:18 p.m.
What was the total cost of this?
Total cost. You sound like my wife. The total cost was. Yeah, I didn't keep a spreadsheet. I actually put together a budget and stayed pretty close to it. The thing you need to know is originally I planned on building two identical robots because the competition allows for multiple cooperating robots. So I have enough parts to build two with a few extra spare parts in case something broke. I probably have $3,000 U.S. invested in it. But the more expensive part is I actually took 8 weeks off of work to do this. So I took an unpaid leave of absence to work on it. So here's a situation where it couldn't get directly to it and had to. Well, and it's not supposed to do that, but it should still find its way around here, and once it does get lined up with it, it should put it out then. Oh, it'll keep trying though. It has charred itself a few times when it got too close to the flame. I can actually aim those sensors by hand. Usually, just before I try it, I do some testing and I aim those sensors and try to lock them down so they don't move. But for it being on the other side of the world and not, Paul's not quite as familiar with it as I am. It seems to be stuck there, but it's okay. It's moving. So any other? Yeah.
Just another tech. You use basically. Some of the hardware timers on the ARM board that are available to you to do a lot of the clocking.
Yeah, it's simply, yeah, it's just using the regular 100 kilohertz system interrupt, yeah.
Okay. Oh, the system interrupt?
Yeah, it's the regular system interrupt as far as all the timing, yeah.
Timer tech
control? Yeah. Yeah, so when it's happening once a Jiffy, it's toggling the...
Because
the,
if you move forward to 2622, I'd skip the 21 to mm-hmm. get the high resolution.
Yeah, that's something to be interesting. That would be something interesting to play with. I should try that. Actually, the next, the next design I have in my head that I'd like to actually build is, since the I2C stuff did not work well, I really want to do that in hardware. And so what I'm thinking about doing is having like an 8-bit parallel interface, just using general I/O pins. Or if I really want to study, I could make a PC104. Device that actually hooks into the regular ISA bus, but then have that hardware, since the AVR microcontrollers I'm using can actually do I2C in hardware. So have a parallel bus to say, send this data out on the bus, and then that would all be, oh, okay, it's actually gonna make it in there this time.
It's not perfect.
Oh, it wasn't quite out. That's strange. I wonder if Paul put some trick candles in there. But now notice how, you know, it was almost out. It thought it was out, but you know, that's the beauty of the that's really strange. But as soon as it sees a flame, the bit of code that tries to put a fire out becomes active again. There were a lot of people that had things much more hard-coded that they said, I put that fire out, that fire's out, and it moves on. But this is, you know, it's very robust. If the, you know, the fire flames up, it, you know, it bumps into the candle a few times, but the fire still gets put out.
I guess probably a single negation would turn it into a nice charcoal fan.
Oh,
to blow when it sees the flame.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and it's not much more complex than that, really, that particular thread. So, is that pretty much all our time, I think?
Say thanks to Paul for it.
Yes.